This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The shattered shorelines along the Indian Ocean, the numbing numbers of dead, injured, and missing, the desperation of millions. These awful pictures make recovery seem a distant prospect at best. But if we step back for a moment, history suggests that cities and villages almost always come back from disaster. Consider the 1906 earthquake and fires in San Francisco, Berlin, and Tokyo after World War II, the floods 15 years ago in Bangladesh, the rebirth of Beirut. Why do we rebuild from the ashes? Does it make a difference if it's a natural disaster or man-made? Is reconstruction the same as recovery? Later in the program, as governments pledge billions to aid tsunami victims, we'll find out whether they've honored those promises in the past, and we'll talk about a new survey that shows a significant increase in the numbers of women who decide not to use birth control. But first, resilience and recovery. If you've lived through a disaster, earthquake, war, hurricane, flood, call and tell us what it was like to rebuild your city and your life, about both physical and cultural recovery. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. One of the phenomenons economists are pointing out about this disaster is that despite the magnitude, the damage to the economies of the tsunami-hit countries appears to be relatively minor. Joining us now to talk about this is Rakesh Shankar. He's an economist at economy.com and joins us from his office outside of Philadelphia. Good to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Explain this to us. How can something so devastating seem to have such a relatively minor economic effect?
Yeah, it's a very disheartening thing to say, but I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that it's a weird confluence of providence and geography. The fact that these tsunamis, the regions that they've hit, have been less industrialized regions, and unfortunately, the populations that have been hit have been among the poorer populations, even within the countries that were hit. And so because of the combination of these two factors, the overall macroeconomic impact in terms of GDP and growth is going to be very limited, both in the near term and the long term. The important thing, of course, is there will be key regional implications and key human costs and social costs that have to be dealt with. But in terms of the macroeconomy, the impact is going to be very limited.
You spoke about providence. For example, in India, the major industrial city there, Mumbai, formerly Bombay, Sri Lanka's main port, Colombo, mm-hmm. both on the western side, they weren't
right.
hit.
That's right. I mean, both of them were avoided hitting. But even more than that, I mean, there are two major ports on the eastern side in India, in Chennai and a place called Vizag, Visakhapatnam, which is a huge shipbuilding center. But Chennai is the second largest port for India, and there's a considerable amount of auto exports, for instance, that goes through Chennai. But the port essentially reopened for business the day after the tsunami hit. So late Monday afternoon, early Tuesday, they were back on track again. And as a rule, generally, when tsunamis do not impose too much of a damage on ports because they tend to be deep-sea ports. And basically, places that have shallower beaches are the ones that are hit the most because clearly the waves are larger and the impact is larger as well. So in general, ports do tend to come off on the easy end when tsunamis hit. But even having said that, the Chennai port seems to have made an almost miraculously avoided any serious troubles at this point.
Obviously, the island of Sumatra and its Aceh province are most seriously hit.
Right.
There's a lot of oil and gas production there, but it's offshore.
A lot of it's offshore. And the other thing, that's exactly the same thing. I mean, ships basically that were out on sea are largely safe from the effect of the tsunami, because the tsunami's effect really only manifests itself once the waves get close to the shore, and again, the shallower the beachheads are. And so the farther out they are to the shore, these structures, these ships, are usually built to withstand these high waves and strong activity anyway. So they've largely avoided it. The bigger miracle there is also there's a huge LNG terminal, for instance.
Liquid natural gas.
That's right. Liquid natural gas terminal. ExxonMobil's terminal, right off the coast of Aceh, not very far at all from the epicenter of the earthquake. And they actually made it through just fine, just because of the time when it hit and the waves that actually hit it were relatively shallow there, and they were able to sustain it without any real stoppage of work.
And as some have pointed out, a nuclear power plant in India also unaffected.
That's right. The Kilpaka power plant was also largely unaffected. It was shut off safely, and it was been turned right back on again. So it seems to have avoided the most devastating potential impact of this.
Yet two important industries, tourism and fishing, were affected.
That's right. I mean, I think if we start to examine the long-term impact, and what are the things, I think there are three main questions that you can ask in terms of what the long-term impact of this will be. The first, how soon does tourism rebound in Thailand and Sri Lanka? These are really the two countries that will be affected, specifically Sri Lanka, because Sri Lanka is trying to diversify its economy past textiles, because it's got a significant textile industry. The industry is getting hit this year because of the elimination of textile quotas, and so it was trying to rebuild tourism as a potential alternative, and it was working this year. They had a huge surge of tourist inflows earlier this year, and so now the question is, how soon will it be able to rebuild the infrastructure, the supply end of the tourism, to be able to deal with tourists? We don't believe that this tsunami is going to have any impact on the demand end. People are still going to continue flowing through Thailand and Sri Lanka. So the demand is going to remain strong. It's not a problem. It's the supply. How well will specifically countries like Sri Lanka be able to get its infrastructure, its hotels, its roads, its bridges back up to track again to be able to funnel these tourists to different parts of the country? The second question would be, like you said, agriculture. How deep is the impact of the agriculture turndown, especially the fishery turndown, in Indonesia and India? So these are the two countries where these two industries will probably be affected the most. India, it seems, is going to make it through okay. Indonesia, it's still on the fence. About two-thirds of Indonesia's fishery output comes from the Western Islands, and so parts of it could be affected medium term. And fisheries are a major export for Indonesia as well. So that's a concern. That's something we have to look at and see how quickly these communities are able to get back on its feet again and get back out. And about 85 to 90% of the fisheries in Indonesia are from small sector fishermen, basically, the ones that have been washed away by the storm. So that's an impact. And the third long-term impact is, how does all this affect fiscal balances? Several of these Asian countries have pretty bad fiscal balance sheets. They have deep deficits. Indonesia has a very high external debt burden. So the question is, does all this aid that it's giving to its people and reconstruction effort, does it hinder or affect its fiscal balances more? And more importantly, all the aid that's going to come in, the reconstruction aid that's coming in from the rest of the world, what form does that aid take? Is it aid in terms of grants? Are they zero-interest loans? Are they deferred loans? So that will also decide the long-term impact, the long-term fiscal impact of this hurricane, of this tsunami.
How did markets, the stock markets and things like that, respond in places like India, Indonesia?
Yeah, it's very surprising. I mean, most of them were flat to up. In most cases, they were actually up for the week in terms of the impact. And this also reflects the fact that the areas affected were the least globalized, were the least connected, so to speak, to the larger market and the larger economy. In many of these countries, the industries and the companies listed in the stock market tend to be infrastructure and online companies. And infrastructure industries like coal, cement, steel, engineering companies, construction companies, all of these companies stand to benefit from the tsunami because of the additional work that's going to come in. Mm. And so because of that, stock markets in many of these companies actually enjoyed an uptick in the wake of the tsunami.
And again, all of this has to be presented in the context of the awful tragedy in human terms. Nobody's ignoring that, and I know you don't either. I just wanted to give you a chance to reinforce it.
I know, absolutely. I mean, 150,000 deaths is nothing to shake a stick at, and there's no beginning to comprehend the full human and social costs of this. And we will continue to see that. I mean, this reinforces the need that there's still tremendous need in these countries. And it also reinforces the call of several banks and development agencies in looking beyond purely just GDP when a country tries to decide what is growth and how it's been developing. Clearly, GDP or industrial output is not the only indicator of how an economy is doing. And so what we looked at today is a very small chunk of what the economy ought to be. And the real human and social costs are clearly just devastating.
Rakesh Shankar, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Neil.
Rakesh Shankar, an economist at economy.com, and he was with us from his office outside of Philadelphia. Again, we're talking about recovery and what recovery means. Is it just reconstruction? Does it go beyond that? If you've lived through disaster, earthquake, war, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Vail. He's the co-editor of The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. He's with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston, and it's very nice of you to be with us.
Thanks, Neil.
And your book suggests history shows that places there's a human impulse to rebuild.
Yes, there is. It's remarkable that if you look across the last 200 years or so, there's almost no case where a substantial city has failed to rebuild. We often lose villages, but it seems that the larger settlements come back in quite remarkable ways, even under the most devastating circumstances.
And obviously, in this circumstance, we may lose a lot of villages, but I guess Banda Aceh is the most largest city that's been dramatically affected by this earthquake and tsunami.
Yes, I think that is probably at least 150,000 people. And then certainly cities like Chennai and Colombo, though maybe spared the worst of it, nonetheless have the impact of refugees and other sorts of intimate connections to the hinterland of their own regions. So they're hardly unaffected by it.
And one of the things that was fascinating about your book is that this, you talk about the need for a narrative, that the people need to rebuild, in a way, to rebuild the story of their lives.
Yes, one of the things that's so striking is how quickly the talk turns, at least in part, to questions of opportunity and progress. There's this kind of human effort to find a kind of silver lining. I don't know whether a tsunami has a silver lining like a cloud does, but it's worth thinking. In San Francisco, for instance, in 1906, the editor of Harper's, a matter of days after the devastating earthquake and fires that were there, wrote that the city was certain to arise quickly from its ashes, greater than more and more beautiful than ever. And he said that those who 5 years hence shall behold the brand new splendor of the resuscitated capital, the earthquake of 1906, with all its unparalleled destructiveness, will serve only to point a moral and adorn a tale. This sort of thing was happening as a rather commonplace reaction, even in the face of destruction. It doesn't happen for everybody, and certainly the distance is there for many. In Oakland, for instance, the paper there said, "Never mind the unpleasant things of this terrific episode in our history. Think of the good times coming." That was a matter of days after San Francisco had been destroyed.
More on disaster and recovery after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how cities, villages, towns, and countries recover after sustaining destruction. Obviously, we're talking about the wake of the tsunami in the Indian Ocean. Of course, you're invited to join us. If you've participated in reconstruction, rebuilding either physical or cultural after a disaster, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Larry Vail. He's co-editor of a book called The Resilient City and a professor and head of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at MIT. He's with us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. But joining us now to talk about the significance of international aid is Stephanie Bunker, a spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, and she's with us by phone from her office in New York. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Yesterday, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan said that while the international donor community has pledged a lot of money, it was quite likely that at the end of the day, all of it would not be received. Is this a common problem in history?
This has happened in the past, for sure. This happened last year with BAM earthquake. In the beginning, there were a lot of initial pledges of money that would be forthcoming. But if you check the financial tracking, as far as I can tell, the money that actually came in amounted to about $116 million or so.
And what percentage of the amount pledged was that?
About 10.
About 10% of the amount pledged.
Well, it wasn't necessarily pledged, but there were indications of pledges where donors said, well, we'll give this or we'll give that or we'll give the other, yeah.
Indications, and I don't mean to be cynical here, that probably found their way into the newspapers.
They may have.
Yeah. Is there anything that can be done to ensure that money promised is money delivered?
I think that it is everyone's job to follow up on that. I think it's the UN's job. I think it's NGOs' job. I think it's also the job of NGO coordinating bodies. I think it's also the job of the the member states as well,
mm-hmm.
to remember what they're saying and to deliver on it. I am hopeful on this one because the disaster is so widespread and so severe. I am hopeful that the member states will remember what they're offering to give.
Again, you gave the example of BAM of 10% of the pledges received. Is that typical?
For a natural disaster, I don't know that that is typical. I know that for complex emergencies, it's a different kind of situation, but every year we fight for money for complex emergencies, which are countries like Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda. And there you don't necessarily get pledges up front, but you just fight the money battle all year. And we will get anywhere from 30 to 70% of what's required in those cases. So again, in meeting the needs of people in complex emergencies as well, the track record could be better, and we want to see that improved.
Is complex emergencies a euphemism for man-made disasters?
No, not necessarily, but they may involve a man-made disaster as well. Often complex emergencies involve a civil war. So that's why I was mentioning countries like Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, where there's a war going on in the north, Somalia, where there has just government has come into place. But these are emergencies that are complex because there's usually a lot of factors at play and many things that are wrong.
Mm-hmm. And one more question, and that has to do with the calculation of this aid.
Mm-hmm.
The United States, for example, ships from the U.S. Navy are very active right now in disaster relief.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously costing money above and beyond what they would have been what it would cost to keep them in port or doing whatever they were planned to do. Is that money going to be calculated, again, based on history, as part of the disaster aid?
That's not known yet. I mean, so far what we're counting is the money that donors say or write to us that they will be giving. We will have to wait and see how they allocate that, because right now a lot of that money that's been indicated to us is not against any one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right now on Thursday is the day when we'll be launching our appeal. We'll finally be coming up with a number of how much we think we need for the immediate near future. And then we will have to look and see at what donors are saying they're going to give, at what we need, and how these two can be put together, whether the money they say they're going to give is going to meet those needs or not. It may not.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie Bunker, I know you're very busy. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Stephanie Bunker, spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. She joined us by phone from her office in New York. Now, let's continue our conversation with Larry Vail about resilience and recovery. And just to follow up on something we were talking about with Stephanie Bunker, does resilience seem to matter as to whether it's a man-made disaster, the bombardment of London, say, or a natural disaster?
It certainly does matter, because there's a micropolitics in every one of these cases. But the fundamental fact is that people have seen their lives suddenly disrupted in a way that has transformed their environment and left things utterly transformed. And there is a process of recovery on many dimensions that has to begin from that common premise, regardless of the cause of it.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the politics matter mightily depending on the cause.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation, and we'll begin with, is it Angel or Angel who joins us from Fort Wayne, Indiana?
Angel is all right.
Angel's okay? Well, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just want to make a comment about Mexico's earthquake back in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
Has been about 25 years after the earthquake, and still a lot of buildings that are still damaged and people still living there. Government has do nothing to help them out. I remember even comments of people that the French guys who came to help with the earthquake, with the, you know, the finding bodies and all that, they got dogs stolen, you know, trained dogs stolen in Mexico City, and that's pretty sad. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, after 25 years, still many buildings in Mexico City that are falling apart, and people still live in there.
Larry Vail, Mexico City is one of the places you write about in the book.
Yes, it's a chapter in the book, and one of the things we point out actually fits quite well with what the caller said, in part because the government at the time failed to respond as directly and to make the recovery of the low-income people at the center of the downtown the highest priority, and instead appeared to be worrying about stabilizing international financial markets. Many people now believe that it led to the long-term rise in social movements and the ultimate demise of the one-party rule of the PRI in that country, so that it may have had rather profound political reverberations in the years to come, even though the recovery for some has been very differentially experienced.
Mm-hmm. This phenomenon operates on other levels, too. I mean, even on a much smaller scale, the big snowstorm in New York that, the plows didn't get out on the streets. A mayor lost his job.
Certainly that happened in Chicago. I don't know about New York.
Oh, it happened in New York, too.
It's really been a time when people watch the government to see whether they're responding in the right way, and sometimes it can have profound political consequences, because after all, no matter what the cause, the people who run a city are charged with keeping their residents safe, and when they fail dramatically in these kinds of disasters.
And when they're seen to perform well, as many people believed President Bush did after 9/11, that also rebounds to their benefit.
Certainly, and there's almost always a connection early on to some sense of progress and opportunity, and sometimes that leads to opportunism as well, a less desirable aspect of trying to cope.
Mm-hmm. Angel, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and have a good day. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Greta, and Greta's calling from Berkeley, California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on
Thank
the air.
Thank you. Sure. I'm going to talk about the initial question that you had, is why people stay in the same area. And I think it's because neighbors become closer to each other. After something like that, they come outside and get closer. I lived through the 89 earthquake and the 91 fire in the Bay Area, the Oakland fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some friends who have lost their homes and lost everything. And when you're together with a friend and you console that friend, you get closer with one another. And people don't want to leave the area where they've lived for a long time, getting close to these people. I also think it's very exciting to rebuild. So over here, the Bay Bridge went down, and the San Rafael Richmond Bridge was being rebuilt, and it continued, and it got even faster. And so what happened was people were very excited about that. This new bridge went up. It's not new, but some freeways, too. It went up really fast instead of the slow pace that we're supposed to have. And it was a very exciting time, even though it was a sad time. And I think people stay in the area, especially the Bay Area. People love the Bay Area. They live here by choice. And I don't know where they would have gone, where they choose to go.
Larry Vail, that sense of excitement and recommitment to a city and to community that Greta's talking about.
It's absolutely the case. The power of places and people's attachment to them is a constant throughout history. And if it's possible to rebuild where you are, that's just what people will do. And it is always the rebuilding that is social network by social network, not just building by building.
And that's what you'd I think Greta would probably agree with this, what you're talking about in terms of cultural redevelopment as well.
Yes. Yeah, I think.
Either one. Greta, go. Why don't you go?
Yes, I really think so. This Bay Area has a great deal of cultural culture. People here are very diverse, and some people have asked me, why don't I move to the suburbs? And to me, that's absurd. I wouldn't do that because I would miss this diversity. And so I would not want to be out in the suburbs or in the country at this time in my life, because it's a very exciting area to be in, and the culture is terrific and very rich. And also after the fire, there was a grocery store on one of the main streets here, and people put up all these signs. signs, just like they do elsewhere, of have you seen my dog? And is an apartment rent for you nearby? And so that became kind of a community area for people to get together and talk and help one another. And I never heard anybody who wanted to leave the area.
That, which goes to another point you raise in the book, Larry Vail, memorials.
Yes, memorials are often, if anything, these days becoming an even more urgent and early aspect of the recovery process. It used to be that you would go 10, 20 years before beginning to memorialize an event. And now the process of constructing a memorial in Oklahoma City, for instance, after the Murrah Building bombing in 1995 or the situation in Lower Manhattan, there is a rush to think about how to begin to interpret and internalize the event, which causes all of the different voices to be heard at once and sometimes makes very clear that some people's voices matter a whole lot more than others.
Greta, thank you very much for the phone call.
Sure, thank you.
We're talking about resilience and recovery in the wake of the Indian Ocean tsunami. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our guest is Larry Vail of MIT, co-editor of The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. And let's get another caller on the line, and let's go to Bill. Bill's calling from Goshen, Indiana.
Yes, how do you do?
Very well, thank you.
Show. Yeah, I, as a high school student, I remember what was referred to as the Palm Sunday tornadoes. And it didn't hit the, it was in the city, but it was sporadic out in the country, killed 300-400 people throughout, you know, the area. And in the aftermath of that, I remember Lyndon Johnson flew over and landed, and you know, I was a high school student, and all of the work and the recovery. But now it's just like a historical anecdote. This many years later, only so many people don't know anything about it or don't remember anything about it. There's still some trees in some of the areas that were really hit. In this one trailer park, there were a lot of trees that were bent way over, and they survived. So now you have people might comment, well, look at those trees bent from the southwest, but that's the only memory. You know, everybody pitched in. I remember walking through farm fields the week after the tornado because farmers couldn't get into their field. They were just covered with all kinds of debris and everything. And walking side by side, you know, abreast, picking up just every amount of debris. And even I remember finding a body, you know, 3 days after the it had such an impression. It meant so much of my life, but, you know, now all the people, you know, they say, oh, yeah, there was a tornado, but they can't remember it, things like that. So, you know, it does recover, and certain images, you know, if you live through something like that, you'll never forget them, but the majority of people that never experienced it have no recollection at all.
Mm. That's interesting, Bill, and I wanted to ask Larry Vail about that idea that these incidents, whether it's something like a tornado, what, back in the mid-60s, if it was during the Johnson administration, or something, you know, obviously more dramatic, they enter the legend of the place where they happened, the mythology of the town, if you will.
Yes, they certainly do. And sometimes the problem is such that the town becomes so identified with its disaster that its major struggle is to stop being regarded as the place that has been stigmatized by its problem. Johnstown, Pennsylvania, after the flood, or more dramatically, Hiroshima after the nuclear bomb. Those places don't want to be known only as the victim of some place, some terrible disaster, but have to figure out ways of moving on from that.
Mm-hmm. Bill, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The other thing about resilience, of course, you mentioned Hiroshima, Nagasaki as well. Those are both thriving cities today.
They are indeed, it's to the point where if one travels to Hiroshima, as I did, it's almost indistinguishable from the development, the rampant kind of chaotic development that characterized most other Japanese cities. And even experts on those cities have trouble identifying it as having experienced quite different consequences during the Second World War, except for the fact that it has a very large peace memorial in the center that was done with the full support and collaboration of the American occupation forces.
Stay with us, Larry Vail. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion on some of the phenomena that lead to resilience and recovery. We'll also look into reports that fewer adult American women are using birth control and ask why. If you'd like to participate in either conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now, we're continuing our discussion of how people and places recover from major catastrophes. Our guest is Larry Vail, co-editor of The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. And Larry, one of the interesting towns, villages, cities are put in that location. There's a logic behind it. It's a port, or it's the headwaters of a river, or the confluence of two rivers. There's a reason a city is there, even after a disaster. That logic doesn't change.
That's absolutely right. I'm struck by what happened in Chicago in 1871. The famous fire and the even more famous recovery from that fire was largely possible because the entire economic hinterland of Chicago was untouched by it. And so the dramatic rebuilding that could occur was a function of where that city was in its region and just how strongly it was able to come back because the city could be built in brick rather than wood the next time. There was a relatively small loss of life, and it was seen as a tremendous economic opportunity in large part because the good things about that city's location remained constant even after the disaster.
And one of the things in the book is what's happening to cities like Detroit and Cleveland. It's not a disaster, but nevertheless, these cities have been bleeding populations as their economic rationale disappears.
I think that's the toughest one of all, and we don't deal with it very centrally in the book, in part because it's so tough. There you have, in many cases, a regional growth at the expense of the central city, but those slower declines into economic irrelevance, in some cases, are the hardest to explain and the hardest to counteract.
Let's get another caller on the line. Steve joins us from Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the Oklahoma City bombing and how I have a feeling in my mind that it helped propel our city forward. We initiated a sales tax for MAPS, which was a metropolitan area projects, which is help revitalizing our downtown. I don't think that was their intent, but even with all the tragedy that came about with the bombing and the tornadoes that we have here in Oklahoma City and the surrounding area, that just that little bit of oomph probably is helping propel our downtown forward. We've come a long way. Our downtown is really starting to thrive now, even after the bombing and all the infrastructure and stuff that they're doing downtown. It's really amazing that even after such a tragedy that they can go forward with all that.
In a way, it's a challenge to the human spirit, isn't it, Larry Vail?
It is. It's certainly a challenge, but it's even more dramatically, I think, a window into the power structure of the society that has been stricken. It really tells us who we are as a people, both in our strengths and in our weaknesses, because as much as we talk about the institutions of disaster management, things like charities or insurance brokers or compensation funds, it's really about value-laden questions of equity. who sets the priorities for these kinds of communities? How are we going to value the needs of low-income residents in relation to tourist facilities or disrupted businesses? Those kinds of questions. Who decides what's going to be built, rebuilt where? Which voices are going to tell the dominant story? Those kinds of questions. So they don't just tell us about who we are generally. They tell us about who we are in relation to the complex society.
Steve, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, sir.
And Larry Vail, I wanted to thank you for your time as well. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Larry Vail is a professor and head of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, co-editor of The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. He joined us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston.